the buzzer. McCord on its way. Oh my goodness.
They have to get it with no timeouts. They do.
Courtside with Cats and Coach G, the definitive college basketball podcast.
Welcome to our latest edition of Courtside with Cats and Coach G. I'm Andy Katz, along with my co-host Seth Greenberg here in our Bristol studios. And Seth, a lot to get to from the past weekend and a look ahead to a monster game in the ACC that maybe a lot of us didn't predict. Florida State taking on Duke, and the Seminoles looking like a potential deep NCAA tournament team this early in January. So let's get to first the debate of the day, and we're going to be joined on our podcast by Baylor head coach Scott Drew, Nevada's Eric Musselman for an unbelievable, epic comeback that if you didn't see, we will recount for you. And then Northwestern's Chris Collins. Is it time to start talking about whether or not the Wildcats, for the first time ever, could make the NCAA tournament? But let's deal first with Baylor versus Villanova, because we're taping early on Monday morning, so the AP poll has not come out yet. But there could be a debate. Who will be number one in the country at a time when college football is naming its national champion? Will it be Baylor, number two, entering the weekend undefeated? They remained undefeated with a close victory over Oklahoma State. Or will it remain Villanova despite losing on the road at Butler? What's your choice there, Seth?
You know me, Andy. Whether it's one, two, three, four, five, it's January, and it really doesn't make a difference to me. I mean, it really doesn't. But if you look at, you know, if you want to break it down, I mean, and again, you know, Baylor's got the win against Oregon. Now, that was without Dylan Brooks. They got Michigan State. They got Louisville. They got
Xavier.
Oklahoma, Xavier. I mean, they've got quality wins. You know, the win against Purdue was a huge win for Villanova. The win against Creighton on the road was a huge win for Villanova. The Notre Dame win was a good win for Villanova. So, you know, it's apples and oranges. I mean, here's what I'm going to ask you is, which team is better suited to win a national championship?
Villanova.
That's really what it comes down to.
I didn't even hesitate.
So you're going to say you're all in on Villanova.
Yes.
And like you could say, well, wait a second. Now, Baylor's got a front court player, Jonathan Motley. That's maybe a tougher matchup that they can play through. Manuel Conte is doing a great job of making plays at the end of games. They play man. They play zone. They've been terrific defensively, Baylor. They have role players that embrace their roles in Alaric Freeman and Ish Wainwright. They've got legitimate depth. So, I mean, you could build a case for either team. You know, which one is the very best right now? You might say that it's because they have more guys who can score. Now, which team, if they played each other, who would win? You might say it's Villanova because I don't think the zone and the defense and really going to bother Villanova because they're so methodical. You got to remember, Andy, these are two teams that play at a very slow pace, two of the slowest paces in college basketball. I mean, you're looking at a Baylor team that plays at the 341st slowest pace in college basketball. You say, well, that's really slow. I mean, man, I didn't realize that with all those athletes and, you know, how their size and everything else. And then you look at Villanova, they played at 324th slowest tempo. What both teams do is they don't pitch it around, don't turn it over a bunch. They don't give up a ton of second shots. Villanova doesn't turn you over as much. You know, I don't think either of those teams are going to win national championship. Let's put it that way.
But I'll just tell you,
for who's number one. But, you know, for the pundits, I don't know. Who do you like? You like Villanova.
Here's my thing, and we'll move on after this. I actually would keep Villanova number one based on the fact that Villanova has better road wins at Purdue, as you just mentioned, and at Creighton. Those are better road wins than what Baylor has achieved so far. So I actually would keep Villanova number one despite losing last week at Butler, which is not a bad loss at all. So that's what I would do. So I want to move on to what you saw on Sunday, which was an absolute beatdown. Carolina just destroying NC State. When we were in studio together Saturday night, you were kind of down because you were hoping to see that game Saturday night. It was postponed due to the snowstorm down in the Carolinas. And I know Mark Gottfried wanted to play the game Saturday night instead of Sunday, and maybe he would have had a different result, who knows. But clearly, that had to be one of the more shocking in terms of you know, lopsided results I think we've seen in the last couple of weeks.
In what, quote-unquote, a rivalry game. But, yeah, it was shocking. Here, Carolina was unbelievable. Look, you're going to play in the ACC. You're going to play 18 games. You're going to play one or two where, you know what, it's just not right. Your team is just not right. You're not locked in. You're not focused. You're getting foul trouble. Your shot selection's not what you want it to be. And you're going to play against a team on that night where, to be honest with you, that Carolina's defense was absolutely phenomenal. Their defensive game plan on Dennis Smith, outnumbering him every time he caught the basketball. They contested every catch. They contested every shot. They had tremendous pressure on the basketball. They had active hands. And every single missed shot deflection ended up in either a transition opportunity or a good offensive possession for Carolina. And, you know, North Carolina State helped with their shot selection, especially early in the game. I thought Dennis Smith, he threw back-to-back really lazy passes that ended up in runouts. Then I think he tried to do too much. He took a couple of quick, ill-advised shots with bad floor balance. Mark Godfrey tried to change defenses. Carolina did a great job of attacking their zone, moving the ball, getting behind the defense, knocking down shots. Look, it happens. It happens. And it can happen at North Carolina very easily against a very talented athletic team that makes shots, that has experience. And I say it all the time, Joe Barry, you can talk about all the analytics, 42 points in the paint, 40 points in the paint, 42% offensive rebound percent. You can have all that you want. Joe Barry makes that team go. Joe Barry took it on himself yesterday to defend the ball, defend Dennis Smith, be alert, be engaged, and he got his team engaged. So you're going to get beat down every once in a while when you're playing that league. That's just the way it is.
All right, so I think already four games in, the most intriguing race of any major conference will be the Big Ten. What we saw over the weekend, I think, is just an indicator of what we're going to see throughout the course of the next 2 months. And we're going to be joined by Northwestern head coach Chris Collins. We'll get his opinion on this as well. So Minnesota knocks off Ohio State. They're 3-1. Purdue beats Wisconsin on Sunday at home, and they extended that lead, you know, significantly in the final couple of minutes. They're 3-1. Michigan State, which has been injured, now got healthy with Miles Bridges back. They're 3-1 with the one loss, by the way, them getting humbled at the Palestra on Saturday by a Penn State team, which has been erratic throughout the course of the season, but they're very young. Nebraska, 3-1. Maryland, 2-1. Wisconsin, 2-1. And now we can't forget about Northwestern 2-2, and don't sleep on Indiana, despite the fact that they're 1-2. Where do you see this race right now, just a couple of weeks in?
I see a lot of teams that have a small margin of error, whether it's playing style, whether it's injury, whether it's developing chemistry. You look at the Big Ten. I'm really impressed with Minnesota. I think they're playing really good basketball. Mason is a tough matchup. They've got great length up front. They protect the front of the rim. You know, they're just a very good basketball team. But across the board, you see a very deep league. They don't have the strength at the top that they've had in the last few years. I'm not looking at any of those teams, Andy, and saying, you know what, that's Final Four team.
None of them.
They could be, but no, I don't see. You know, I thought early in the season it was Indiana, but you know, I don't.
You don't think Wisconsin can get there?
You know what? Wisconsin can get there if they can own the tempo of the game. Although they're a better offensive rebounding team than they've been in years past. To me, Happ is a very tough matchup on the baseline. He's so skilled. He's like the medium sized fundamental. I mean, he puts on a clinic every single time he plays, and Nigel Hayes is a very good player. I mean, he's a terrific player. But, no, I think, yeah, they could get there, but I don't look at them as a Final Four team. I don't look
at them. What about Purdue?
Purdue, I'll tell you what I like about Purdue right now. I like that they can play big, and they can play big. And what I mean by that is they can play the two big guys together, and the team will have a certain personality. And then they can play on the block more as a five, where he can also pull your five away from the basket. And that to me is interesting. They shoot the ball at a high level, and the reason they went to that is, you know, a lot of times in the league, you're going to be able to play Vince Edwards at the four athletically, like he did last night a good deal, and you're going to be able to play Swanigan at the five. He can move his feet against Happ a little bit. It opens up the court, and they shoot the ball so well. I mean, they really, really shoot the ball well. And do I think they're a Final Four team? No, I don't think they're a Final Four team. I think they're a very good basketball team. I mean, the league is deep. There's excluding Rutgers, who's playing hard as could be, there's no real bottom of the league. I mean, what Penn State did to Michigan State the other day was really impressive. I mean, they have good young players. Stevens kid, the Carr kid, they're playing with more confidence. This is a Penn State team that is starting to turn it. Can they deal with the constant grind of the league? I don't know, but I mean, Shep Garner's a nice player. Lamar Stevens is a tough matchup. He's kind of a little bit like a Draymond Green type player. Peyton Banks makes jumpers. Carr's done a nice job running the team. And this kid, Mike Watkins, a redshirt freshman, yeah, I mean, he's a good player. I mean, so they've finally got Big Ten talent. So if you look around the league, there's no rocking chair games. You're going to have to win your home games. I mean, I like the young players at Maryland, and I like the way they're using Melo Trimble. I like the young players at Iowa. I think Iowa's young kids are playing with a lot of confidence, obviously a lot of fire. Peter Jock could go off on any night. Tyler Cook is a tough matchup. And I think that, you know, they're a team that, you know, is going to continue to get better. The kid Jordan Bohannon, who I didn't realize was that good, the point guard, has made big shots for him. Very good player. Very good player. So you look at the league and you say, look, there's nothing great at the top. When I mean great, I mean like just that jumps out at you. Wisconsin's very good. But the depth of the league, Andy, is incredible. And then you got an Ohio State team that's 0-4 and really struggling. And they're at the bottom of the league. You know, Illinois has been inconsistent, but you eliminate Illinois, who's in the conversation for the NCAA tournament, Ohio State and Rutgers, and who is not a game that if you do not play well, who are you going to beat?
I tell you,
if you don't
thing,
play well, who are you going to beat?
No, I agree with you. And the one thing that I love about Tom Izzo, among many things, was the fact that he was pushing to play the game at the Palestra, and actually after the game, you know, he not only apologized for his players' performance when they just clearly didn't play well against Penn State, but he also apologized to the facility. He actually said he was sorry to the Palestra that they didn't perform at a high level. And Mike Jensen of the Philadelphia Inquirer, had a great line in his column after the game and said that when reached later in the day, you know, the Palestra had no comment. it's something like that. I'm paraphrasing.
But Tom
here
understands the history.
Yes.
He wanted a coach in that building.
Yes.
I mean, he wanted a coach in that building. If you think about it, he's probably coached in every great building in college basketball because he's at Cameron. He's played at Carolina. He's played, obviously, in the great facilities in the league. I'm not sure he's played at UCLA or not. But, I mean, the tradition of the – it's a cathedral. It's a cathedral of college basketball. And you know, it's a great environment and a brilliant idea by Penn State. Students are out. So what is he goes to the students. He brings his team to the students and his alumni and pushes and builds his base. And also, by the way, his elite freshmen are all from Philly. Great move by Penn State.
A great move. All right. So let's stay in the Big Ten.
Right.
And we are now joined here on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line by Northwestern head coach Chris Collins. Fresh off a Sunday victory at Nebraska, 74-66. Lindsey Scott had 15 of his 19 points in the second half, and this was despite a 16-0 run by Nebraska that straddled the two halves. Chris, you guys were coming off a disheartening home loss to Minnesota. I watched that game. You guys were right there to win that and couldn't get over the hump to beat the Gophers, a very improved Gopher team. So going into this Sunday game against Nebraska, you hate to put all the marbles into one game, but how critical was this game to get you guys back on a winning direction to really get some momentum in the Big Ten?
Well, we definitely felt a sense of urgency for the game. You guys know, following this, you know, one of the keys about conference play is everybody's going to lose some games. The leagues are just too good. You're going to have a few games here or there you drop just because of who you're playing. And for us, we had lost two in a row. We had gone to Michigan State, lost a hard-fought game, came home, had a 7-point lead in the second half against Minnesota. They made a lot of plays down the stretch to beat us. And you have to avoid extended losing streaks in conference play. You know, you can't let two losses become four or five. And, you know, that's how you really, you know, get yourself into a hole and get yourself into a tough spot. So although there's still a lot of ball to be played, I think we all felt a sense of urgency in this game yesterday that, you know, we needed to go to Nebraska and we needed to do everything we could to try to get back on the winning track.
You know, look, you guys are in a league that there are no gimmies, and that's been the case really throughout the course of your career, whether it was in the ACC when you were an assistant at Seton Hall, the Big East, and now as a head coach of the Big Ten. But, you know, it's interesting, the unbalanced schedule that you guys face where you only play Wisconsin once, you're done with Michigan State, now you do get Indiana twice, you do get Purdue twice. You know, as you sort of look at what you have to achieve here, and you don't have any bad losses so far this season, going forward, you know, this next game at Rutgers, how would you sort of characterize the mindset of your guys of valuing each game as if it is sort of a deciding seventh game?
Yeah, you know, what we try to do, and who knows if it's right or wrong, but we try to liken our conference slate to like an 18-round boxing match. You know, you go out every night and you have a round you got to fight against another opponent. And you have to put everything you got into that round. And there you have to be single-minded with your focus, your energy, your preparation. You can't think about the last round. You can't think about what rounds are ahead of you. You got to think about what's standing in front of you right there. And it's just a little thing we do to try to keep us in the moment. Because, like you said, these leagues, and especially the Big Ten, and I've said it a number of times, I don't remember it being as even and as balanced and, you know, as the parity the way it is this year. I mean, you know, we're all saying, man, can you believe who won that game and who won this game? And I think it's going to be like that all year. I think, you know, every game anybody can win, doesn't matter where the game is, home, road, and you got to just stay on that straight and narrow, and you got to stay with what's in front of you, and you got to try to win that game and go for it, and that's what we've tried to do.
Yeah, it's a next game, next play mentality, because if not, it can overwhelm you. I remember when Skip Prosser, when I first went into the ACC, he said you can't kind of get sidetracked by what has happened game to game. He said, we were number one in the country at one time. He said, and we had Duke, Carolina, and State three in a row. He said, we lost all three. He said, we lost all three. He said, and you know what? It's just like you got to deal with in your league. You might not have the Dukes and the Carolinas right now in the league. I'm not sure the top of the league is at that level. But the depth of the league, you know, I was just saying a second ago, there's no rocking chair games in the league. I mean, if you don't play well, you're not going to win in your conference. You've got to play well each and every night. And Derek Pardon, you get him back. What does that do to your depth? What does that do to your rotation? How hard is it fitting him back in after having him out for an extended period of time?
Well, it was huge to get him back into the lineup. You know, Derek for us is our anchor. He's got a great voice on our team. He may be our toughest minded guy on our team. He's a rock for us. His activity, not only what he can do offensively, scoring in the post, being able to throw the ball in there a little bit and manufacture some scoring, but his ability to hold it down defensively, which is huge. As you know, defending our basket, being a weak side guy, defending the post, his length, his shot blocking. And really the good part about it was, you know, because it was a hand injury, you know, the time he was out, he was able to do a lot of conditioning. He was able to do a lot of running. He was able to do a lot of sliding. You know, so when he was cleared to come back to play, it was more just getting used to catching the ball and getting hit a few times and taking a couple falls and realizing that he was okay. So it was kind of a seamless transition, and we threw him right back in there that Minnesota game, and the two games he's been back, he's played great for us. And, you know, hopefully during that time, we were able to develop a little bit of depth. Gavin Skelly was big for us during the eight games that Derek was out. We threw a freshman in there, Barrett Benson, who got some valuable experience at 6'10". You know, so now you have a little bit more depth on the front line, especially in a conference that's so physical where you need big guys to be able to go in there and give you productive minutes.
Chris, you know, you've been under the microscope kind of your whole career, if you think about it. I mean, being the son of a great player and a terrific coach, and then, you know, choosing to go to Duke and playing under that microscope and now coaching in the big. So you've kind of understood what that's all about and the pressure of that. And, you know, as you're watching what's going on, you know, at Duke right now with Grayson, you know, what would kind of, from your experiences, what advice would you give either Grayson or someone in a similar situation about dealing with that microscope, that pressure? Because you've lived it probably since your freshman year of high school. Being under that microscope, looking at anything and everything you've done.
Yeah, I just think, you know, it's something that's a compliment, because, you know, in my situation, it was kind of having a famous parent. So, you know, I didn't really have a choice. I was going to be looked at. I was going to be watched, especially choosing to be a basketball player and a coach. So in Grayson's, you know, situation, he's earned that because of how good he is and his success and what he did on the big stage and to win a national championship and all those things. And like, you know, coach, I mean, being in at a place like Duke, you were in the ACC for a long time. It just, everything you do there is going to be magnified, and you kind of understand that when you choose it. I mean, there's a lot of good that comes from all that, the attention you get, the spotlight, the exposure, the opportunity to play for coach, the fans, all those things. And, you know, the other side to that is you're going to be magnified in every decision you make, every little thing. And to be quite honest, it's so different now than even it was when I played or coached there because of social media. You know, and I talk about it all the time with my former teammates, like in a certain respect, when I was there playing, we could still be college kids a little bit. You know, we could have some fun. We could be kids. And everywhere we went, there weren't camera phones and people tweeting and, oh, I saw this, I saw that. And so it's even more magnified than it's ever been for these guys playing at these places like a Duke, like a Kentucky. And, you know, I think for Grayson, he just got to play. And unfortunately, because of some of these incidents, his situation, everything he does is going to be talked about. It's going to be scrutinized. It's going to be watched. And it's something he's going to have to deal with. And the thing I like is the support that he has around him with coach, with that coaching staff, Jeff and John Shire, Nate James, Nolan Smith. There's no better guys to help him through a situation, because all of those guys went through that as well as players. All of those guys can kind of help him. And look, when you're in that position, you know, in a little bit too, you got to kind of embrace, you know, and enjoy the position you're in. And, you know, I tried to do that as much as I could, you know, when I was in high school and people are chanting at me and you're at Duke and people are saying and stuff, try to enjoy that. Try to not use that as pressure, not use that as, you know, getting angry about it. Just enjoy that spotlight and enjoy that attention and try to use it as motivation to help you become a better player.
And you can certainly say that Christian Laettner and to some extent J.J. Redick did that. All right, one more before we let you out of here. I remember a couple of years ago, a little longer than that, when I went out and spent some time with Bill Carmody when he was the head coach at Northwestern. He was consumed with getting Northwestern to their first ever NCAA tournament. You guys are completely different personalities. But how have you avoided sort of being, you know, just sort of enveloped with this albatross, this, you know, elephant of trying to get this program to the NCAA tournament for the first time?
Well, you understand it. I mean, I'd be lying if I said that wasn't a big motivational challenge for why I wanted to come here, amongst a lot of other reasons. But, you know, that's kind of the way I'm wired. You know, I've always kind of been told, you know, I was too slow and unathletic to play in the ACC and, you know, this or that as a coach. And I always use those things as motivation as a competitor, to try to prove things differently. So, for me, I've tried to enjoy the whole process. It's been very hard because I'm not a very patient person when it comes to competition. So, you know, going through the first couple years and trying to understand that building something really good is a process, and it takes steps that you have to go through. One of them is learning, you know, through losing at times. And, you know, I think it's made me a better coach. It's not made me any less competitive and less excited about trying to do this. I understand what everybody wants. Everyone wants to go to the tournament. You know, everybody wants to get there. And for me, that's just a step, really. I want to build a program here. You know, this is my home. I love Chicago. I love this school. It's a great school, great people. We're playing in the Big Ten. To me, we have everything in place here. We're undergoing a $100+ million facility project that will start as soon as our season ends, with arena, practice facility, offices. You know, everything's in place here for us to have something that's not just a one-hit wonder. You know, I want to go to the tournament badly, and as does everyone, but my main focus all along was, can we build a program? You know, can we build a situation here where we can be good every year and we can be good competitive every year? And really, that's my goal. And the next step to that, though, is getting to that tournament. And I know it's going to be a lot of happy people and a lot of happy former players and alumni and coaches when we get that done. And I think we're off to a great start, and hopefully we can keep playing well and give ourselves a chance here down the stretch.
Appreciate it, Chris. Thank you.
All right, guys. Great to talk to you.
All right, going from one program trying to get into the NCAA tournament for the first time ever in Northwestern to one that potentially could be the number one team in the country as we're taping this, Baylor number two. Throughout the course of the weekend, they moved to 15-0 after their victory over Oklahoma State. So Scott Drew now joining us here on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. Scott, why should the Baylor Bears be the number one team in the country?
Well, I think it goes to your body of work, and we've played a very competitive schedule and been able to be successful against a lot of well-coached and good teams. So at this point, I know every poll you can always argue several different teams. I think with our team, obviously with the top 25 wins and the top 50 RPI wins and the fact that we haven't lost yet, definitely you can make the case for the Baylor Bears.
Scott, this team's gone from not rated to number one potentially. What's been the biggest surprise? What's been kind of the biggest difference in the personality of this team to get you where you are right now?
Well, I think the depth and versatility. You look at we've had several games where we've had different people step up. The battle for Atlantis, for instance, in the championship game, King McClure and Jake Lindsey made phenomenal plays down the stretch, and it's been different people off the bench. It's been starters, but everybody's helped contribute, and that's allowed us to be able to be undefeated at this point. And I think the other thing is we have great leadership, and as you know, Seth, in the huddles before the coaches get in there and out on the floor when the five guys huddle up. If you don't have that good leadership, no matter what you say, you're not going to be successful in all the close games. And we've had that. We've had a lot of poise when we've been down, when we've been up. We've stayed focused when we've had a lead. We've been able to build on them. When we've been down, we haven't gotten rattled, and we've been able to get back in the game and make the right plays.
Yeah, you mentioned that you've trailed five times at halftime and, of course, won all five because you're undefeated. Games against Oklahoma State, Xavier, Louisville and Michigan State down in the battle for Atlantis, and VCU as well in that same tournament. But this could be short-lived because your next two games are at West Virginia and at Kansas State. We've talked on the air all over the place that Baylor and West Virginia are probably the two teams that could challenge Kansas the most as you enter this West Virginia game where they turned TCU over 18 times over the weekend. How do you guys handle the basketball against a team that's going to try to take it from you?
Well, it's definitely hard to prepare for, and it's a style that you don't face often, and that's why they're so successful, and there's a reason Coach Huggins has won over 800 games. He's really good at what he does. First and foremost, whenever you hear that they turned over a team 40 times in a game, that sends off a lot of bells and whistles because they've been good at pressing before, but this year it seems like they're even better at it. And we gotta do a great job in practice preparing today. And then hopefully when we get down there, we can take care of the basketball. And then the next big thing is make sure that you rebound, because their best offense is sometimes the shot off the glass and getting it. And as we like to say, when that ball goes up, that's a time where it's a 50-50 ball. It's anyone's ball, and West Virginia is as good as anybody at getting those.
You know, you look at your team, and that's the one area, defensive rebounding, where you guys have struggled a little bit. Not struggled, but you're not as rated as high percentage-wise as other areas. But, you know, you hit it. It's rebounding, and it's taking care of the basketball. So, like, you're in practice today. All right, you're going to show them film. You're going to talk about personnel. You're going to talk about what you guys are going to try to do in terms of tempo and, you know, getting into a half court. And it helped play in Oklahoma State, a team that got after you in a different way this past week, and more overplay in the half court. But you're going to go into practice today. So are you going against seven? Are you adding an extra rebounding drill? Are you just – that's going to be, you know, the focus every single – are you going to start with a certain number of basketballs at the start of practice, say, when we run out of these balls, we're going to run more? I mean, what are we doing today?
Hey, I'm going to let our team know all those ideas. I think they're going to like them all. but in normal years, I think you do seven. This year, you probably got to do eight or nine out there. So, but those are all areas of they've seen the film yesterday, and we begin prep, and those are all things that coaches do to try to get ready. A big thing is, like you said, we played Oklahoma State, and Coach Underwood's a tremendous coach, and runs a similar type style. He was with Coach Huggins at Kansas State, so that will help prepare us a little bit, especially in the half court, because they really did a great job against us in the half court.
Well, Scott, we appreciate it, as always, joining us here just after dropping off the kids at school down in Waco, which has been made maybe more famous by Chip and Joanna Gaines than by the Baylor Bears, but that's okay. Maybe they can rebuild a house for you now that you're so successful.
Can you tell those people to start coming to your games? Your games are so much fun to watch.
I know. What's
you
up with that?
You guys play so hard. Can you tell those people, like, let's fill that place, not just for Kansas, but for Baylor, please?
I love it. I love it. Well, we actually last game against Oklahoma State set a attendance record, so tied it with the most that we've ever had at the game. So appreciate your
awesome
thoughts on that. Chip and his family, in fact, came. They brought the whole family and a bunch of the employees to the last game. So they are definitely the show in Waco, Texas. So the fixer-upper, everybody, if we can keep them out of New York and L.A. and everywhere like that, we can get them to games here in Waco.
All right. Appreciate it, Scott. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, guys. You have a great
good
day.
Luck,
if you
coach
want to come to Morgantown with us, we'd love to have you.
Okay. All right. When we come back here on Courtside, we will be joined by Nevada head coach Eric Musselman for an unbelievable comeback that if you didn't see, you got to hear about. So all that's still to come. But first, Seth, not all ingredients are created equal. Fresh, high-quality ingredients, you got that, make a real difference. So it's important to know where your food comes from. Everyone's got to know that. So I got signed up for Blue Apron about a month ago, and I really enjoyed the experience. I know my kids did. I had the three meals. I used two one night, and then I used the third a couple days later. The food was fresh and absolutely delicious. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. You don't got to go to the supermarket. It's easy. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients, and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. And we've all got busy schedules. We're all running around, so that makes a difference. Blue Apron's freshness guarantees promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/courtside. You'll love how good it feels, tastes, to create an incredible home-cooked meal with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/courtside. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
He steals it, gives to Truly, who knocks down a triple.
He misses both of them. Nevada's still in it. Here's the handoff I was talking about. Boom.
Marshall for three. Yes. The lead's nine. Fires the three. Hit it again. two-possession game. Seven-point game. Caroline, yes!
They're not going away. The clock is ticking. They're down six.
Ramsey is in a screen from Caroline. Gives to Marshall. Immediately Hoyce. He was hit. Banked it home anyways. Nevada wants the foul. They don't get it. Three-point game. Caroline's got 40 tonight, including a few threes. Marshall's hit a couple late. He goes up, some contact. Oh, Cole! He banked it in anyways! And we're tied at 94! Ball inbounded to Caroline. They cross out court with 6 seconds. He fires a three! Rattles home! And Nevada leads with 2.9 seconds left. They inbound to Brown. Up the floor, throws up a prayer, won't go, and Nevada completes the comeback. They win for the first time ever here at the Pitts.
All right, so you just heard some highlights from the unbelievable comeback of Nevada at New Mexico on Saturday night, 105-104 in overtime, as Wolfpack take down the Lobos at the Pitt, their first ever victory at the Pitt. Have to admit, I was doing halftime with Alan Cuff of that game, and after halftime, you know, we were done for the night, and I was driving back, and I kind of missed it. So I'm glad I caught up with it, because we were watching the game throughout the course of it, and we missed the final couple of minutes because I was on my way home. But just a couple other things to crystallize here. Marcus Marshall had four threes in the final 52 seconds, okay? Charlie Tooley sort of got it going with a three-pointer with a minute and three left. Jordan Caroline had 45 points. That's the Southern Illinois transfer. He had a three amid that comeback. And just to put this into perspective, New Mexico was up 14 with a minute 10 left. They were up 25 with 11 minutes left. And Nevada won this basketball game as New Mexico went 5 of 10 from the free throw line during that stretch down at the bottom of that game as things just completely flipped for Nevada. Eric Musselman now joins us on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line, the head coach of the Wolfpack. Eric, when you're down 25, I'm not even going to go yet to the 14, what did you tell your team when you're down 25 with 11 minutes left?
Well, Andy, it's great to be on with you and Seth, but the main thing that we talked about was respect, because last year, we were in a situation where the season before Nevada had only won 9 games, and so we talked about every night we had to play hard, we had to gain respect of opposing players, opposing coaches, referees, media people in our league, and then national media people, and we felt like we had done that. So in the timeout, some of the things that we talked about when we were down 25 is, hey, just as quickly as you can gain respect, you can lose respect, and we didn't feel like we were playing with the level of intensity that we had for a year and a half. We really did not have any blowouts last year other than at the Pitt and at Wichita State. And we felt like during the course of at least that game up to that point that we had not competed like we had this season. We had two losses by 1 point and a tough one at St. Mary's. And so that was really the message that was delivered was, we have got to play with much more intensity. We were embarrassing ourselves. There was even a timeout where I said absolutely nothing to the group. So we were struggling defensively, struggling offensively. And there's a lot, obviously, involved in what happened from that moment on around the 11-minute mark.
You know, look, there was a time, and I'm watching you as I'm watching the end of that game, you could see your emotions sort of starting to go, wait a minute, like this could actually happen. You're jumping up and down. You're coaching them, defensively. And then they hit some crazy shots. What is it about this group that you've empowered them to feel so confident to just go after it, play a little loose, and, hey, just take some chances when you're down, 14 with 70 seconds left?
Well, I mean, our guys do play loose. Our shot selection at times – from other coaches, from myself, can be questioned. For instance, in that game, we took 32 threes. But when we got the job at Nevada, we talked about trying to play fast. We talked about trying to play cosmetically pleasing to the fans. We have completely changed the style, especially from a shooting aspect.
2 years ago, Nevada was ranked in the 350s for three-point percentage, and now we're one of the better three-point shooting teams. And the big thing really to me as the game progressed was the self-coaching that took place, because we talk to our players all the time, especially in the summer, that we can only be as good as you guys coach yourselves. The coaching staff can want things, but if the players can't talk like coaches and deliver the same message, then we're never going to be really good. And I thought in the huddles, especially Jordan Caroline and Lindsey Drew to a degree as well, and DeVerl Ramsey, our freshman, those guys started uttering phrases that the coaches talk about. And then they started, you know, once we hit a couple threes, and it really started with a walk-on Charlie Tooley. Once he hit a three, all of a sudden now we started looking up at the clock and we started thinking time score. And we knew that luck had to be involved, because New Mexico, they really were playing well. It wasn't like they played a bad game. They were playing phenomenal. They were playing as well as we've seen them play on both ends of the floor. And they didn't go to their bench, really. I mean, they played Tim Williams 41 minutes, and so it wasn't like there was a mass substitution on either side, other than the fact that at about the 9-minute mark, I put in John Carlson, who's a local walk-on from Reno, and Charlie Tooley, and the reason those two guys were put in was to kind of inject a little bit of energy. Because we only have 7 scholarship players right now. We felt like some of our guys were trying, but they just had no legs. And then after Tooley hit the three, I went to put Marcus Marshall back in the game, and Marcus looked back at one of the GAs and he said, "What is coach putting me back in for?" And I had overheard it, and I just said, "Hey, Marcus, just go in and see what'll happen." And then obviously, you know, Marcus hit some miraculous, you know, shots that we've never worked on or talked about off the backboard, and falling down and you know, through a little bit of preparation, we have a segment called the L2M, last 2 minutes, that we work on a lot, and through some luck of missed free throws and such, and then some wild shots that happen to go in. You know, we get that thing to overtime.
Mus, you've coached at every level, all over the world. You've lived it. You grew up with it. Have you ever seen or been part of something like this, even in the NBA, where you have so many more possessions?
It's never, Seth, ever. You know, after the game, I told the team, you know, having – seen all the games that my dad coached and going on the road trips, even at 10 years old and on, and then being a part of, you know, basketball immediately upon graduating from college, I've never, ever seen anything like it. Been a part of it, seen anything like it on TV, just because of the, you know, being down 25, is one thing, but then what happened in that last 5 minutes. And so I kind of look at it like three parts. One, you know, in the second half down 25, then the second segment is at that 5 minute mark, what we're down by. And then when you look at the last minute, what we were down by, those three areas, you know, if you just look at the history of college basketball, in those three areas, I mean, it's something that has not happened. And if it has, it's only happened a few different times in each of those segments that I talked about. And then to me, the amazing thing was then we get it to overtime and then we're down 5. And at that point, you know, do we have enough gas? Then we started having players foul out. Marcus Marshall fouls out. Cameron Oliver was playing a game that he was struggling in. Jordan Caroline had 4 fouls. Lindsey Drew fouled out. DJ Fenner fouled out. So in that overtime, we were playing guys that hadn't had much experience in a game at all, let alone in an overtime game in one of the most difficult places in the country to play.
Don't worry, Huffnagel is going to take full credit for the win, so it makes no difference. You look at where you're at now, you talk about kind of like a basketball vagabond. Why have you been able to
Is that your nickname for him?
No. Why have you been able to get Nevada this quickly, this competitive, and then just at the end of that, I know I'm supposed to ask something twice, two questions at the same time, but what did you say to Coach Neal what do you say to the guy who, he had the game under control? Probably answer that one first, and then where do you see Nevada moving forward, I guess is the question.
Yeah. The thing when you win a game like we did against New Mexico, and especially with somebody like Craig Neal, who Craig actually played for me, there's not much you can say. And, the one thing that we did talk to the media about immediately after the game was how well New Mexico did play, that we do recognize that there was luck involved and some shots that you would never imagine went in. And New Mexico's got a veteran team, and I'm sure they're going to bounce back because they are one of the most talented teams in the league and one of the most well-coached teams. And you feel for anybody that played well enough to get a win, which certainly they played more than well enough to get a win. And there's really not much that you can say other than the fact that our team has unbelievable respect for the New Mexico Lobos without a question. And then, where do we see Nevada going? And we've been really fortunate in year one to get two freshmen in Lindsey Drew and Cameron Oliver. And we made a decision in the first year to play those two freshmen over seniors. And it was a risky thought process to play two freshmen and to start them and oftentimes play them over 35 minutes in games, but we knew that it would help us in the long term. And then we went out and got three transfers in Leland King and Jordan Caroline and Marcus Marshall. And then Marshall, because it was a sit one, play one, gives us great leadership and a veteran who can really score the ball. And then as we look forward, we have two excellent freshmen on the team this year, DeVerl Ramsey, who played a huge role in that New Mexico game by playing 33 minutes, and then Josh Hall, who's not with us right now due to a concussion but was starting. We made a decision to start Josh Hall, a freshman, over a three-year starter in DJ Fenner to try to help speed up his development. And then we have three sit-out guys that will be able to play next year in Kendall Stevens, Caleb Martin, and Cody Martin. So we think the future here is really, really bright. To have as many sit-out guys as we have from the transfer market in year one and two has really affected our depth both last year and this year. Not any depth really at all other than going seven deep, but we felt in order to try to win as much as we could in year one, year two, and then going forward in year three and four, it was worth the wait on the transfers. And so we feel like we've got to continue to develop our young guys on a daily basis. And then for the sit-out guys, we're so proud of how Jordan Caroline's developed and Marcus Marshall while these guys have been sitting out. And so it'll be our job to continue to spend time and work with our sit-out guys and try to get our young guys better.
Well, Eric, an unbelievable comeback. For those that haven't seen it, definitely check out it online. We gave you a little bit of a taste of it. And the Nevada Wolfpack right back at it because they're at Wyoming in the next game. Eric, appreciate you joining us. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Andy. Appreciate it, Seth.
All right, Seth, so you asked Chris Collins of Northwestern about sort of what's it like to play at Duke under that microscope and about Grayson Allen. So let's go back because I know you've discussed it a lot with me on ESPN, ESPN2, on SportsCenter. So first, how did you think it was officiated between Grayson Allen and Boston College's Connor Tavey and him going over that screen and no call being made?
I thought it was officiated correctly. I mean, Connor Tavey, he didn't even react to the situation. So, here's the thing. The announcers didn't say anything. The officials didn't react to it, and nor did the player. Now, think about that. All right? The three people that are literally engaged in the game, the people calling the game, the people playing the game, all right, and the people officiating the game. So, to me, look, can we look at it in the closest form and say
it's like the Zapruder film?
His leg up too high. Yeah, you know, you can, but basketball is a contact sport. You're going to get locked up. And I know I've got a lot of abuse on Twitter. Like, you know what? You've never played in a competitive game.
We all get abuse
at
on
that
Twitter.
High level. All right? You're trying to fight over a screen. You get locked up. All right? Now, all of a sudden, you continue to fight through the screen. You lose your balance. Did his leg kick up a little high? Yeah. You know what? He got tripped earlier in the game running down the floor. Incidental, non-issue, but if it happened the other way around, it would have been an issue because he basically hasn't earned the right to the benefit of the doubt. But I think it is a non-issue. We cannot look. The kid can't be afraid to play. All right, if he's afraid to play, you might as well not put him on the floor. The two bigger issues to me: one, the move to point before Coach K left was brilliant. All right, because now you can't have a volume shooter on one wing in Tatum, a volume shooter on the other wing in Kennard. You're trying to get Harry Giles touches on the block or in the high post. You can't have a volume shooter on one wing in Tatum, a volume shooter on the other wing in Luke Kennard, a front court player like Harry Giles who's now moved into the starting lineup that needs touches. You can't have four and five volume shooters on the floor. Someone's got to give up a little bit of themselves for the good of the group. Brilliant move, Coach K. Say, hey, right here, Grayson, this is your role. You can score. You can have a ball guards mentality at some point, but you've got to facilitate. You've got to get other people involved. You've got to think pass first. You've got to keep us organized. You've got to receive the outlet pass and look for hit-ahead passes. That's been a huge move. And you know what? He responds with 7 assists the first night, 11 assists the other night, and offensively, there's a better flow to their offense. The other big issue is Emile Jefferson, because if Emile Jefferson's out, that is a huge loss for Duke. You don't have to run a play for him. He's always in the right place defensively. He's a terrific screener. He can play 4 and 5. He's a ball mover. They have no replacement, in my opinion, for Emile Jefferson if he's out. That's a bigger issue than if Grayson Allen caught someone with the back of his leg fighting over a screen.
All right, so a couple quick things here. First of all, no update yet from Duke as we're taping this Monday morning on Emile Jefferson's status. It's the same right foot that kept him out for all but 9 games last season. We obviously hope that he's going to be okay and can return whether sooner than later at some point here for Duke. And actually getting word as we're taping, Duke telling me right now that there still is no news yet on Emile Jefferson here on Monday morning. We didn't mention Dylan Brooks, though. He was ejected from the game for the way his leg kicked back up as he was falling down against Josh Hawkinson from Washington State. The Pac-12 reviewed it. They said on Sunday there will be no further action, which means that because he wasn't ejected for fighting, Dylan Brooks can play in their next game against Oregon State. How do you think that was adjudicated?
I think correctly. In fact, I talked to 3 or 4 Final Four officials this past weekend, the guys that worked the Final Four. And they said the Grayson Allen thing was a non-issue. And they said the Dylan Brooks thing was adjudicated correctly. Here's the thing. His leg was behind him. His leg kicking up is not the issue. All right, because, look, he had to release his leg. It was the extension of his foot, all right, to the private parts of Hawkinson that was the issue. And, you know, that was a flagrant two. And, you know, it could have been a flagrant one, but the officials decided it was a flagrant two, and it was a kind of excessive. It was not a fight. And it was basically he was kicked out of the game, and it is what it is. And now let's play on. And it's a first offense. We shouldn't over-respond. And these things happen, and you move on. Let me tell you something. Both of those things are not as bad as what happened in the Georgia-Missouri game.
Why?
Because in the Georgia-Missouri game, you had coaches, people that are supposed to lead, supposed to set the example, getting involved in an altercation. To me, that is much more egregious.
No, I agree with
than
you.
Anything that happened with Grayson Allen and Dylan Brooks. Because you know what? Yeah, look, you get heated during games. You're going to have words. But you know what? You separate, you move on, and you play on. And, you know, I'm a big Kent Davidson fan, who is the director of basketball operations for Mark Fox. He coached Mark Fox at
with Georgia, and then it was Steve Shields with Missouri.
And it was just silly. I mean, come on. Like, you've got to act like an adult. You've got to act like a coach. You've got to act and make the right decision and say, you know what, you'll walk away from that. You don't escalate it. And, you know, to me, nothing that could have been said as those coaches were passing could have gotten them to the point to behave that way. I think both coaches need to be put behind the bench for still be on the staff, don't get suspended a game, but put behind the bench for a certain number of games.
All right, Seth, before we get to student section, a quick prediction from you, or at least a quick analysis breakdown. I need your best 30 to 50 seconds on Florida State Duke. What's going to happen and who wins?
I'm blown away by Florida State. I think that, you know, we talk about how long and athletic they are. They're scoring it easier than I've seen them score. They're playing faster. They can wear you down. 11 guys are playing double-figure minutes. I think Florida State wins this game. I think they win this game on their athleticism. I think they win this game on their ability to play in the half court and in transition. I think they win this game with their length and their toughness. And they're playing without any distraction. And sometimes, you know, distraction's a good thing, or sometimes a distraction, you know, tears a team apart. You know, sometimes a cause is a good thing. But I think Florida State at home, I just think this is a potential Elite Eight, Final Four type team.
All right. Well, I think this certainly is going to be an intriguing game down in Tallahassee as the Seminoles potentially could go to 4-0 in the ACC. And this could be Duke's second loss in the ACC if that occurs. All right, time for the student section, Josh.
And here they come, folks. Here they come.
It's time for you to storm the podcast. Let's hear from the student section.
All right, fellas, got three student section questions for you today. The first one comes to us from Alex Rigel. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. But Alex would like to know, if Washington continues this season the way that it's been going and ends up missing the tournament, does Lorenzo Romar get fired?
Well, you know, they do have a big-time recruit. Well, they have a big-time recruit coming in, Michael Porter, you know, for next season. Obviously, there's a family connection on the staff. So I'm going to say no, he doesn't get fired. But I wouldn't be shocked. I'll just leave this caveat out. I wouldn't be shocked if he tries to move before anything were to occur over the next year or two.
Well, he's not going to get fired unless I don't see him getting fired, you know, with the potential to have the number one high school player in the country come in, and who to me is as good as any player I've seen in a long while. Having said that, I would not be shocked, Andy, if he took Michael Porter's dad, and they moved to another institution, and that Lorenzo took a job at the end of this season. And eliminated the problem, the possibility of getting released and getting let go and everything that goes along with that at your alma mater.
Okay, we'll see what happens. Next question from who, Seth?
Who's it? ID Kelly or Drew Abide? My man.
It is ID Kelly. It is ID Kelly.
Drew Abide.
Yeah. We do have one here from Drew Abide. Yeah.
Or?
Yeah, but the first one will be from ID Kelly. There we go.
But we miss ID Kelly.
Yeah,
there we go.
Yeah. We haven't heard from ID Kelly in a couple of weeks, so luckily we have this question
from
him.
Hope he's okay.
He is, because he submitted this question with the hashtag student section. He says, with UCLA, Kansas, and Creighton all shooting above 42% from beyond the arc, some good research there from ID Kelly, will the trend be to think outside rather than inside?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, you want to shoot threes, layups, and free throws. I mean, that's the analytic people will tell you. But, you know, everyone is going, because of the way the game is being officiated, you're seeing more teams go with two ball guards or two point guards, two hybrid forwards and a post player. And playing with better spacing, playing with better flow, and players are getting better and understanding how to play in those two areas. And Yeah, I do think that the wave of the future, our game mimics the NBA game, and you're seeing the same thing happen in the NBA, and I think you're going to see the wave of the future. There's no doubt about it. You're going to see three-point attempts up. You're going to see field goal percentage, three-point field goal percentage up. You're going to see base spacing being a big part of college basketball, and you're going to see teams playing more, quote-unquote, small ball. I think that is the wave of the future in college basketball.
But I agree with him, and you know, or you could just do what Nevada did and just wait till the last 2 minutes and just chuck up threes and hope they go in.
That's always a good strategy.
Bank a couple in, shoot a couple off the wrong leg. I mean, why not?
Seth, you thought we might have a question from the Drew Abides. Sure enough, we do. At Drew underscore Allen 14 with an interesting question. I'm not sure there's a right answer to this one, but it's a good question nonetheless. Drew would like to know, at what point does a program become elite as opposed to just good?
I think if you make multiple Final Fours. I think if you're in a conversation for winning a national championship.
Multiple Final Fours ever or within a period of time?
No, within like a 10-year period. Like if you're a team that's in a conversation each and every year to be a Final Four, I think, or if you know, there's a couple things. I think if you're a top 10 team 4 or 5 years in a row, like, you know, Michigan State's an elite program. I think that Gonzaga's an elite program. You dominated your conference. You're in a conversation each and every year to make it to the Final Four. You're playing on you're doing ratings on national TV. A team that people want to see, that people want to talk about. They're in the conversation in the national profile. I think that kind of makes you elite. Now, I don't know. That's kind of a vague. What do you think, Andy?
No, I agree with you. You know, to me, Gonzaga's become an elite program, but they just haven't been to a Final Four. You can make the same argument that when John Chaney was the head coach at Temple, you know, they were in that discussion. You know, same thing with Purdue under Gene Katie. They didn't make a Final Four under Gene Katie, but they were one of those elite programs. So I think it's cyclical. There are certain programs that I think always have that status, that it's never going away, like Kentucky and, you know, Carolina and Duke, for example.
That's tradition and pedigree.
And Kansas.
There are certain programs inherently, don't you think, Andy, like North Carolina, Duke,
yes.
Kentucky,
it's in the
Kansas.
Bloodstream.
They're always going to be elite programs because that's –
they have the constant money flow of their donors and everything else, too. So I agree. All right, so Florida State-Duke Tuesday night. That's the big game after the national championship game. We'll wait and see. Obviously, new number one could be very fluid throughout the course of this season. That's for sure. All right, so as always, go to iTunes.
Wait a second. One question. Who do you got? Alabama or Clemson?
Oh, I'm going to be...
Come on now. I mean, you got to make a pick.
Yeah, I'll go Clemson.
Roll Tide. It's like they lost the last game. The defense gave up 40 points. Roll Tide. Defense, they got a
ball. Nothing like a couple of hoop heads talking college football.
I'm going to go Clemson.
Just breaking it down.
All right. Just remember this.
It's all right. Don't worry about it. Sean Watson on his back. The defense, right. Bam.
As I was saying, go to iTunes, click on our podcast, give us a great rating, subscribe, send it to your friends. Or the easy way, go to the ESPN app, click on the headphone icon, and listen to us all the time. And follow Seth on Twitter. He gets in a lot of Twitter fights all the time, so it's good theater. At Seth on Hoops. Follow me on Twitter, at ESPN Andy Katz. And as always, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Courtside with Katz and Coach G. You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app or download and listen on Apple Podcasts. Courtside with Katz and Coach G.